When Marcia Brantley was finally reported as missing in fall 2009 by her hairdresser, more than 6 months had gone by in which no one saw her or communicated with her. Most notably, her husband, Donnie Brantley, with whom she still lived, did not report her absence. From previous episodes, we know that Marcia was a smart, tenacious, loyal, independent woman who had learned early in life to have faith that God would meet her needs, and, like the cliche goes, patience is a virtue. While I was researching her case, it was her faith in particular that first led me to follow a new line of academic research, cognitive dissonance, in order to discuss how faith can impact someone in a domestic violence situation. I recognize there's a much larger line of research, so I expanded this section to talk about more of it. Today, we'll outline the theory of cognitive dissonance and explain how it intersects with family violence. Next week, we'll dig into Marcia's blogs and take a look at how she dealt with the cognitive dissonance that she was facing in her life, as well as what we've learned about her from friends and family. Welcome to Targeted, True Crime Podcast. We tell stories of those who were targeted by abuse and investigate cases of family violence, using academic research to interpret the events. As a college professor, I think we need to stop making family violence a secret. It's time to tell our stories, use our experiences to help, heal, and provoke change. Targeted discusses sensitive information about abuse. Listener discretion is advised. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. A quick programming note. Today's episode will contain quite a bit of communication research, more than usual, and we won't begin applying it until next week. If you don't want to explore the theory behind cognitive dissonance and you want to jump to the discussion on how it intersects with domestic violence, you can fast forward in this episode until a little after 18 minutes and 30 seconds. But for the rest of you who want to know the background, we'll talk about how cognitive dissonance theory began and some of those early studies. The theory, called cognitive dissonance, was first written about by Leon Fessinger, a psychology professor. Fessinger taught and researched at a number of universities, including MIT and University of Michigan, but he did much of his work on cognitive dissonance while at the University of Minnesota and Stanford University. Fessinger's idea is that human beings do not like inconsistencies because they make us feel psychologically uncomfortable. We become stressed when we have inconsistencies in our beliefs or values or actions, so we strive to reduce the anxiety by finding a way to reduce those inconsistencies. Let's say I made a New Year's resolution to eat healthy, and I do pretty well for the first few weeks of January. I feel proud of myself because I've resisted temptation many times and stuck with healthy choices. But then someone brings a box of donuts into work, and I impulsively eat one. I now feel bad because I am inconsistent. I have set a value of healthy eating and invested work in following it so far, but I ate something unhealthy, and this inconsistency is stressful between my belief and my action. I will be driven to find a way to make the value in this action more compatible so that I will not be as uncomfortable or stressed. I will likely do this by either lessening my commitment to the value or minimizing my action. I might say, I value eating healthy most of the time, but not all of the time, and that may make me feel less inconsistent. Or I might reconsider the action and say, well, I went 3 weeks without a break, and it is pretty remarkable that I waited that long. In fact, that is the longest streak of healthy eating I personally have ever accomplished. So, yay me! You did a good job, Mo! it is this thought process in which we try to make these inconsistencies less. Fessinger considered that humans are driven to resolve inconsistencies or this cognitive dissonance. It's not simply that we choose to do it, but that we all have an internal drive that we need to fulfill. We need to avoid the state of inconsistencies that make us feel anxious and stressed. Fessinger thought this drive to be true of both large and small things in our life, so we're fairly regularly engaging in reducing the inconsistencies. Even though we're driven to reconcile both large and small inconsistencies, we are more motivated to find ways to resolve larger inconsistencies because they have a higher magnitude of stress than smaller inconsistencies. Let me use one of the classic examples of cognitive dissonance using the concept of how I react when confronted with someone who begs for money from strangers. For instance, let's say that one of my values is to help people. I may donate money to a homeless shelter. My church may be involved in some charity activities. I might serve in a food kitchen. I might start a podcast to educate people about domestic violence. All of these actions support my belief. But one day, I am stopped at a traffic light. I'm about to get on a freeway, and I see a bedraggled person with a cardboard sign that says, "Hungry." I suddenly have seconds to make a choice. Do I roll down my window and give that person money? Do I hand the person the granola bar I have bought for my breakfast and is sitting right next to me on the car seat? Or do I stare straight ahead and pretend I do not see them and leave as quickly as the light changes? If I choose that latter action and leave, I now have an inconsistency. I think it's important to help, but I chose not to help in this situation. This makes me feel uncomfortable, so I need to find a way to make both things compatible again. There are many ways I can do this. I might tell myself that I really have no knowledge that this particular person truly needed help. For all I know, this person might make a lot of money doing this, and they're actually living a middle-class life based on the money they earn from begging near the freeway. I would probably use negative words such as begging, as opposed to a more neutral word choice such as asking for help, because it allows me to separate their action from my beliefs. If I convince myself of this, I no longer have an inconsistency. Well, of course I would help people who need it, but I have no knowledge that this person needed it. In fact, they probably do not. I could deal with the inconsistency in other ways too, such as telling myself it's too dangerous to be handing money out of my window by the freeway, as I could cause that person to be hit by another car. I could also resolve it in the opposite way. After I've left without giving money, I might feel bad with the inconsistency and decide that I made a bad choice, and the next time I will definitely donate $5 to the person asking for help. I might tell myself that while it's true I don't know if this person truly needed help or not, it is better to err on the side of helping just in case they really need the cash to buy food or medicine. Leon Fessinger developed cognitive dissonance theory over many years, running different types of studies. One of his first research projects into this was with a doomsday cult called the Seekers, who believed the world would end on December 21st, 1955, due to a massive flood, as was communicated to them from aliens. Fessinger wanted to see how the cult members would react when December 22nd dawned and the world was still intact. It's too long a story to tell the entire thing here, but it would make a great full-length episode for a podcast that deals with cults. Essentially, midnight came, December 21st ended, with no catastrophic world-ending events. The cult followers were left with intense cognitive dissonance. They held a strong belief that did not come to pass, and now they have to resolve it. Logically, you and I might think that they would re-examine the initial belief that the world would end, and they would now reject it as being wrong. Fessinger had not predicted this, though. he predicted that they would find a way to keep the original belief of the world ending, but add something to it cognitively to explain why it didn't. After a few hours of distress and consternation from the followers, the leader of the cult wrote a message that purportedly came from the aliens, telling the seekers that, quote,
"This little group, sitting all night long, has spread so much goodness and light that the God of the universe spared the earth from destruction,"
unquote. This message allowed the cult members to reconcile what had been conflicting cognitions. They truly believed the world would end at midnight, and when it didn't end, they were stressed by that lack of compatibility between those two things. Again, logically, you would think they'd have to reject one idea or the other, so reject that the world was supposed to end, or conceivably, they could have rejected that they were still alive. They could have decided that they are in an alternate universe now. The note, however, allowed for both of these things to be true. They had been correct that the world was supposed to end, and they were correct in that the world had not ended, but it hadn't ended only because they were such good people that they saved the world. In Fessenger's theory, magnitude is important. The larger the inconsistency, the more we're driven to reduce it as an internal demand to find a way to address that inconsistency. We just can't let both abide. The greater the discrepancy we're resolving, the more confirmation we might seek to reassure ourselves that we made the correct mental adjustment. In my example of not giving money to someone at the side of the road, I might go to a friend whom I know is fairly adamant that no one should give money to individuals. We should only donate to organizations or nonprofits. I tell my friend the story of how I didn't give money to the person by the freeway and how I'm kind of feeling bad about it now. My friend predictably reassures me that I made the right choice and tells me about how one time he followed a beggar from the street and saw them get into a Mercedes and drive away.
"Begging is all a scam,"
he tells me, and so I feel my dissonance lessen. In a way, this was also the case with the Seeker's Doomsday Cult. They had not sought out publicity before the purported last day of the world, but after the world did not end, they began to seek media attention to proselytize. They were looking for confirmation that they had correctly dealt with the dissonance, and now they had to prove what good people they were, since that is why the aliens spared the Earth. The first decade of research into cognitive dissonance centered simply around what we've just talked about, how people experience cognitive dissonance, and how they naturally talk themselves through it in order to reduce it and seek confirmation from outside sources. The second decade of research was a bit different. Fessenger and other colleagues wanted to know if they could manipulate an experimental situation in which they could create cognitive dissonance and then influence a person to reframe what they thought. So rather than simply studying cognitive dissonance, the researchers would cause it. College students were asked to be part of an experiment in which they had to do mind-numbingly boring tasks for an extended period of time, such as turn a peg a quarter turn in a board or take a spool off of a pegboard and put it back on. It was not designed to be an enjoyable experience. After the tasks were done, a researcher would confide in the student that one of his workers hadn't shown up and he could really use some help from the student. The researcher then offered to pay the student to be a confederate, basically to be kind of a partner, and to lie to the next person scheduled to participate in the experiment in order to tell that next participant that it was a fun activity. Most students agreed and were offered either $1 or $20 to lie. Again, all of this was designed to force them into cognitive dissonance. It was a boring activity, but they had to lie and say it was fun. Most people don't consider themselves to be deceptive people, and so lying causes cognitive dissonance as we do not like to see an action that is deceptive when we don't think we're deceptive people. Fessinger wanted to see if there is any difference in the cognitions for the students paid $1 and the students who were paid $20. He anticipated that some of the students would feel more cognitive dissonance about lying and would convince themselves that the activity had actually been fun, so they would alleviate the stress created by lying to the next participant. When he later measured their attitudes about that boring task they had done, he found that one of those groups said the tasks were indeed fun, while the other group did not. So now I ask you, which group do you think now rated the boring task as being fun? Which ones dealt with the dissonance by changing their attitude and thinking that the boring task was great? Do you think it was the ones paid $1 to lie or the ones given $20 to lie? So essentially, which ones had to do more mental cognitions to reduce the stress they felt from the cognitive dissonance? When I first learned of the study, I was sure it was going to be those who were given $20 who rated the task as more fun now. I figure that the extra money would have raised the stakes for them to make them want to avoid the dissonance. But no, it was the $1 group who rated the activity as more fun. Why? The reward was so paltry that it didn't provide enough of an external reward for them to be comfortable with lying. The ones who received $20 felt like they were well compensated and they had been performing a job. They didn't feel the tension of lying because they felt more like they had been paid to be an actor saying a line. The ones paid $1 did not feel as comfortable, and they felt more stress from their participation and perception of lying. So instead, they had to convince themselves that the activity actually was enjoyable and they hadn't been lying after all. There is so much more that happened after this study, with a lot of controversy about the theory. For a time, it seemed as if a new study by Rosenberg had contradicted it. Then a whole new set of researchers came and showed that Rosenberg's study had eliminated choice and used forced consent, which eliminated cognitive dissonance, therefore negating the need for any type of cognitive clarification. And Rosenberg actually didn't contradict the original theory at all. So the theory survived and has been expanded steadily over the decades. An important aspect was developed from the idea that people aren't always very good at interpreting what they think or what their attitude is about an idea or action and can be influenced by someone else labeling it for them. This relates to cognitive dissonance because someone knows that they're feeling the stress or anxiety but can't quite express it. Someone else can come along and label it for them, which will be accepted and help them reduce their stress or anxiety. On the case of the person standing by the freeway exit, the one whom I didn't give any money to, again, I feel cognitive dissonance. When I speak to a second friend about it, she might take a different track than the first friend, and she might tell me,
"Oh, you felt that way because you're such a good person at heart. But you saw through that beggar's disguise, and you weren't fooled."
She has now helped me to label my feeling as discernment, as opposed to a lack of caring. I hope you can already see some elements to this theory that can be easily applied to domestic violence. When a survivor is faced with two conflicting cognitions, they will seek to reduce that conflict by reshaping one of the ideas. They may seek confirmation from someone else who is likely to influence them by supporting the change of one of the cognitions by labeling it. In the case of domestic violence, someone who has been targeted by violence may reconcile their conflicting cognitions and essentially talk themselves into staying. There's been quite a few studies that have looked at intimate partner violence and cognitive dissonance. Research by Dr. Trudy Mills in Sociology Quarterly reported, quote,
"Victims downplay their abusive experiences through multiple means, including minimizing the seriousness of the abuse, focusing on positive aspects of their lives, and defining their husbands as victims,"
unquote. So they try to look at the bright side of things and to see things that have happened to their husband in the past that have made their husband react in inappropriate ways. Similarly, Herbert et al. Wrote in the Journal of Marriage and Family that, quote,
"They use downward comparisons, during which a victim convinces herself that her situation could be worse, which conversely indicates that she is fortunate for the relationship that she has,"
unquote. So she talks herself through this by saying,
"Oh, you know what? It could be so much worse. Now, listen, girl, you're fine."
I used a 2017 article written by doctors Nicholson and Lutz of Missouri State University fairly extensively while I was preparing the section, and it was their literature review that helped lead me to other articles about interpersonal violence and cognitive dissonance. They summarize much of the research in this way, quote,
"These strategies assist a victim in viewing her relationship in a more positive light, reducing dissonance between the belief that she deserves a good and healthy relationship and that her relationship is unhealthy,"
unquote. While resolving cognitive dissonance may influence a target to stay in an abusive situation, doctors Nicholson and Lutz remind readers that this does not blame the targets for making poor choices, but simply helps us to understand how and why the choices are made. The blame should always be assigned to the perpetrator. Let's use an example. A husband occasionally tells his wife that he loves her, but one night he also berates her for being a fat, stupid cow, and his life would be better off if she'd just die. This creates tension in the wife. She has two conflicting cognitions. First, he loves me. Second, he says things that he wouldn't say if he actually did love me. She is going to have to work through this. She might decide that
he loves me, but has a temper and occasionally doesn't control it. I also have a temper and occasionally I don't control it. Why, just the other day, I snapped at my coworker when he spilled coffee on my report. Our anger, my husband's anger and my anger, it's the same thing. It has nothing to do with love. It's simply a fact that we all become angry at times, especially when another person does something wrong. I got mad when my coworker did something wrong. My spouse gets mad at me when I do something wrong. It's actually my fault, and I will try to do better.
She may also try to work out the conflicting cognitions with her husband and talk about it.
Honey, when I hear you call me a name, it makes me feel as if you don't love me.
Now he has an opportunity to help her reframe it.
Aw, you know I get emotional because I love you so much. If I didn't care, I wouldn't get upset.
She may also seek help to deal with the cognitions in other ways, such as speaking to a friend, such as we've already talked about. When her good friend sees that she is acting a little depressed and asks why, she may tell the friend that she and her husband are fighting and he said something unkind to her about her weight. The friend, without hearing the whole story, will likely interpret this using her own experience. Perhaps the friend will encourage the wife to diet or exercise since she is a few pounds overweight. Now the wife resolves the cognitive dissonance by determining her husband was right in calling her a fat cow. After all, she had not been motivated to lose weight in the past, so she must need strong words such as this to motivate her. It's also possible the friend may reciprocate with the disclosure of her own, because people often reciprocate symmetrically when someone else is confiding in us. Maybe the friend will tell about this great 10-day cabbage diet she tried, or maybe she'll disclose that she had a fight with her husband, but they worked it out. The friend tells the wife,
"Marriage is hard work, but it's worth it."
The wife goes home determined to lose weight and to work harder on her marriage. Or, rather than going to a friend, the wife might seek framing information from a trusted source, such as the Bible. In the case of someone with faith, if they turn to their scriptures, they'll see things that might influence their thoughts. Consider the verse Proverbs 15:1 from the Protestant Bible. Quote,
"A soft answer turneth away wrath,"
unquote. She thinks she needs to work on how she handles herself during conflict so that she turns away his wrath. If his wrath continues, then it's been a failing on her part, and she needs to work more on it. I've been a Christian since I was about 7 years old. I would call myself a Protestant, but I don't particularly tie myself to a denomination such as Baptist or Methodist or Presbyterian. I went to a number of Christian schools growing up, and I teach in a faith-based college now. I can tell you that one of the most significant contributions Christianity can provide in interpersonal communication comes from resolving cognitive dissonance that leads to a reduction in anxiety and stress. There have been a number of studies that look at wellness and life satisfaction among people in the United States using demographic breakdowns. People of faith who attend churches often rank high on life satisfaction scales. I'm convinced myself that it has to do with how we learn to talk ourselves through difficult situations in our lives. We go to the Bible for wisdom, and it helps us cope. Let's say I've been fired from my job because I filed a report that my supervisor had done something wrong. I go to the Bible and I read Jeremiah 29:11. Quote,
"For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you hope and a future."
Unquote. Now, instead of being scared about not having a job or feeling betrayed by a dysfunctional whistleblowing experience, a Christian can look forward and decide that God has a better job for me. Being fired was a good thing because soon I will be in a better situation. I may also look at 1 Peter 2:21. Quote,
"For God called you to do good, even if it means suffering, just as Christ suffered for you. He is your example, and you must follow in his steps."
Unquote. And so I think about my suffering from losing the job, and I determine that it's minute compared to what Jesus faced, so I really have nothing to complain about. I had done a good action by reporting illegal activity of my boss, and even though I'm suffering while being in the right, it is what a Christian is called to do. I cannot control other people's responses to me. I can only control my responses. I cannot count how many hundreds, actually probably thousands, of sermons, Sunday school lectures, and devotional lessons I've had that use Bible verses to demonstrate how a Christian can reframe cognitively and have more peace. And you know what? It works. It's not magic or anything, but I can usually cognitively work my way around to finding some sort of good outcome in many situations. Most of the time, this is a pro-social activity for me that does bring more contentment with my life. But sometimes Christians can go to excess without realizing it. When it came to my marriage, I absolutely could talk myself through dealing with the negatives that were happening to find ways to allow my husband's actions as fine or muster up faith that he would mature enough to leave behind destructive patterns. I think many people would have left my marriage much sooner than I did. I cognitively dealt with the dissonance in what I see now was a minimizing way, and then working very hard to prevent the situations in which he was likely to blow up. When I did talk about problems in the marriage with other people, I was not frank or detailed. I talked vaguely about his anger problems and his depression, but didn't give good examples. I covered for him because, although I wanted advice, I also wanted to keep those details private. I was embarrassed, and I loved him, so frankly, I was just protecting him as well. The details of the things he did, essentially, I cordoned off those memories, those thoughts, in an area of my head that I didn't explore very often once I had talked myself through any initial trauma. I'd convince myself that it was because he wasn't taking medication for depression or because his job was too stressful. And then I just put those memories kind of in a box in my head that was metaphorically stuffed in a locked closet that I would rarely open. I prayed, I sought advice, but again, while not being forthcoming with details. I'd probably have received different messages if I had been clearer, but most Christians I spoke with sympathized that marriage was really hard work and we'd pray about it together. Many Christians also have a sacred view of marriage, and divorce, for some, is not an option. For others, it is only an option in the most severe of circumstances, mainly adultery or physical abuse. Since we're convinced of the sanctity of marriage from a value perspective, the thought of leaving a marriage is an action that would create intense dissonance, much more stressful than that of staying in a bad marriage. It takes something catastrophic to be able to overcome the dissonance that leaving a marriage would entail. This kept me in the marriage for a very long time. I suspect that it kept Marcia in hers as well. Next week, we'll dig into Marcia's blogs and take a look at how she dealt with the cognitive dissonance that she was facing in her life, and I think you'll see a number of patterns emerging that could have led her to stay in a dangerous relationship. Thanks so much for joining us at Targeted True Crime Podcast. If you're interested in my sources or research, I include a bibliography on my website, www.targetedpodcast.com. If you want to support the show, please consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and writing a sentence or two about what you like. If you want to connect on social media, I'll include links in the show notes. If you'd like to reach me via email, you can do that at targetedpodcast@gmail.com. Please stay tuned for promos at the end of the podcast and check them out if they sound interesting. As we end, let me emphasize that if you or someone you know is a survivor of domestic violence, you are not alone. There are resources available to you. I've included some contact information in the show notes and on the website about a few organizations. Leaving an abusive relationship can be one of the most dangerous times for a target, so I strongly encourage you to reach out for support. Getting help may be the hardest thing you'll ever do, but it will be worth it. I'm Mo Blackwell, the host of Targeted. Peace, my friends. Peace.